Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwindiger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines. Hopefully provide some insight and analysis, practical application that you can use to take back to your office and protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
All right, well, the next article is cyber criminals made $7 billion, that's billion with a B, of pure profit in 2021, says the FBI. And this comes to us from the Register. So the FBI released the Internet Crime Complaint Center, or the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, released its 2021 report, comprised of 847,376 complaints that received in 2021 that where businesses lost in excess of $6.9 billion from the attack. So a little bit of rounding there.
So much.
Yeah, it's crazy money.
Yeah, it's nothing. Psh. My crypto is easily $14.
Yeah. But this was a 7% increase from 2020. So the complaints, they broke down into five categories. And this is in descending order from based on volume. So phishing, non-payment, non-delivery scams, personal data breaches, identity theft, and then extortion. Next, they broke down the most popular scams into five areas sorted by and we'll do this in order by the amount of money that was lost by the organizations. So the first one is business email compromise. So this is from 19,954 complaints and totaled $2.4 billion in business email compromise. That means complete social engineering, no malware, no ransomware, nothing. And that's $2.4 billion just from social engineering, really.
That is $120,000 per, on average, per instance.
Wow. And of course, because that's on average, you know that some are a lot more and some are a lot less.
Yeah. Yeah. Because sometimes the business email compromises, go get a couple of, you know, gift cards and send me the gift card codes.
Right. And then some others are, hey, you failed to pin your $15 million invoice. Please send us that money to our new bank account, which is here, and off it goes. But what the FBI also said, which was kind of interesting, is that there and that team, like the Internet Crime Complaint Center, they abbreviate that IC3. So what they said is the IC3 recovery asset team,
the RAT.
The RAT.
Oh, that's a perfect name for a government.
No. And if you look at it, it says IC3 RAT.
Ice rat. You know,
I see three rats.
That's hilarious.
That fits the FBI. So they were able to recover $328 million in 74% of the cases that they were involved in. So that's less than 14% of the $2.4 billion. So they were able to recover less than 14% of that. And if you try to look at that in total, 328 is, well, if you look at it saying, well, if they were involved in 74% of the cases, that $328 million is only 74% of $443 million. And that $443 million is only 18% of the $2.4 billion. So they are not, either they're not getting involved a lot, or their actual return on, or their ability to get money back is not very high.
Yeah, that is not great ROI.
Yeah. So either they were only involved in 18% of the 2.4 billion cases, or their recovery success is even worse than that. Mm. So the next one is cryptocurrency scams, $1.6 billion. And what's interesting about this one is the amount lost at $1.6 billion is a sevenfold increase over the previous year, but fewer complaints. So that means each actual instance had a higher dollar value associated with it than the previous year.
I wonder if that's because of the number of scams, or if that's because of the value of cryptocurrencies exploded so much.
Oh, that's a good point. Because all this is really done via translation. or you know, because when you seal a Bitcoin, you have to say, well, how much is that Bitcoin worth at that instance?
Yeah.
So I think that makes complete sense what you're talking about.
I saw a couple interesting bits in here. They didn't mention rug pulls, and they didn't mention any of the common crypto scams, which I don't know if that was just an oversight or if people that have that happen are reporting it to the FBI. What they did report was there were 1,500 complaints about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency ATM scams with $28 million in losses. So I'm pretty sure everybody knows about like the Bitcoin ATMs. So that, I guess I would be pretty scared if I put, you know, $40,000 into an ATM expecting to get a Bitcoin out. I wonder how exactly the scam works. If it spits out a coin that doesn't actually map to a cryptocurrency or something.
No idea.
Yeah, that was a new one on me, but I guess it shouldn't be. Shouldn't be a new one.
So maybe you should explain the rug pull.
Oh, so a rug pull is a common cryptocurrency scam where one of the recent ones, the Squid Game token, they created a smart contract. They created a token. They sold the token. They were like, oh, look, it's Squid Game related, you know, buy it in while the hype is all here. But it turns out the way it was written, you couldn't sell the Squid Game token back out. You could buy in, but you couldn't buy out. You couldn't sell out. So they just sold all the tokens and then they collected all the money and they just waltzed off. There are other ones where they'll take the money. There's a lot of NFT collections that are being termed rug pulls where they, you know, bring in a celebrity, pay a celebrity or two to advertise it. And then they sell the NFTs and they make a big promise of some stuff will come with the NFTs and you can trade the NFTs. And then they never do anything else after they've sold the NFTs. And then they gradually lose money as people realize that they just bought a silly JPEG. So. Just common crypto scams trying to capitalize on everybody trying to make a ton of money. So I've also seen support scammers on Reddit. If you go into /r/cryptocurrency on Reddit, at the top of every post, it will say something like, we will never ask you for your keys. Never give your keys to anybody's. But basically the scammers surf those subreddits and other places. And when they see somebody asking for help, they'll private message them and say, oh, I can help you. You know, let's do a screen share, or if you'll give me your recovery codes or your recovery phrase or your private keys, I'll be able to help you out. And then they just empty your wallet.
It's interesting that people that need help have very much money in their crypto.
I mean, but it's probably low effort on their part too. You're not making $10 million, but also you're spending, you know, 15 or 20 minutes.
That's true.
So the hourly is probably pretty good there. And the third one, romance scams, we'll talk about in the next one, I think.
Right, because after cryptocurrency scams, we come down to confidence and romance scams.
I could use some romance. How much does it cost me?
One Bitcoin.
Apparently.
So while this is the second highest in terms of number of attacks, only $956 million was stolen as a result of those extortions.
Only? Psh, that's chump change.
Yeah, when you're talking about $7 billion, that's only, you know, so as Matt here has here, that averages $40K per victim. So it sounds like, you know, just average folks end up losing their savings in this kind of scam. Well, of those, 429 was the cryptocurrency scams.
Yeah, I actually recently spoke with somebody who is this is going to be kind of weird. She's a model and her Instagram was hacked. And what the attacker did with the Instagram, maybe she knew somebody. Either way, I don't remember if she got these messages from somebody else or somebody else took her account and was doing it. But they were reaching out to all the followers and saying, hey, I have this new investment and I've made a ton of money. Look how much money I've made. And of course, with cryptocurrency being in the news, it has kind of that, oh, wow. And they would, you know, post it with their accounts that have, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of followers. They would post it that there's this account. They'd just try and convince all these people. And what they would do is they would convince people to buy into crypto. And they'd be like, and then you have to stake the crypto here to stake the crypto, send it here. And they just put their, address there. So people would just send them a ton of crypto and then they would, you know, ghost them.
Wow.
Yeah, it was ridiculously simple. So, and it mostly relied on horny males who were trying to impress a internet girl, an e-girl. So
who they will never, ever meet.
Nope. It's the power of male stupidity.
Yeah, don't underestimate it.
I know, right? I'm 100% on the board that like 90% of achievement in the world is because of males trying to impress women.
Yeah. I think that actually is probably accurate. You know, I mean, some good thing, a lot of good has come from it.
Yeah.
You know, there's some terrible aspects to it as well, but you know, there's an upside. And the next one is technical support scams. So this is the greatest in number with 29,903 reports. And this is generally targeting older, less technical savvy people. And they got 347 million from this. And that's 137% increase from the previous year. And that averages 12K per person, which is, like I said, average people losing their savings. And 60% of the victims are over 60 years of age. And that represents 68% of the total losses in the entire category.
Well, old people are gullible. And actually, this kind of relates. I took a look at the, I kept going down, the report's kind of dry, but I was skimming it. And the top state, I'm skipping the ransomware one real quick for that last thing that I put on there. The top states with the number of victims losses, it's basically by population. The number one state for victims and losses is California. The number two is Texas. The number three is New York. Like all high population states, they all make sense. One exception, the state number eight in terms of complaints is Florida, but they're number four in terms of losses, and it's not even close. The number five state was like 200 million in losses, and Florida was like 500 million in losses at number four, which was just about even with Texas and New York. And I think that's because of this. Although I guess 347 million for tech support scams is not that much. Like maybe, I don't know, maybe that, but all those, I bet that's all those old people in Florida that are getting scammed.
All the retirees that moved to Florida.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I remember correctly, mostly older people get hit with romance scams too. I feel like a lot of them get older men looking for sweet young women.
All right. So the last one is ransomware. Now, if you remember the order in which we said we were going to do this, it's in descending order by total estimated losses. So business email compromise was the greatest number of losses at 2.4 billion. And ransomware is at the bottom with, hold on to your hats, 49 million.
Yeah.
With 3,279 complaints. And it's, believe it or not, Conti ransomware was the variant that made the most money. Now, this seems really surprising because everybody's terrified of ransomware. We've all seen the huge numbers that ransomware seems to cost everybody. And Conti made 180 million last year in ransomware demands. So why are these numbers so low? Only 3,279 complaints and only 49 million in losses. And it seems to be that the majority of these ransomwares are probably outside the United States where they are making their money. The United States is not the chief victim, I guess, of ransomware, it would seem, so, based on these numbers.
Yeah, I just did the math on that. That's only $1,500 per complaint. So I wonder if this is not companies, but individuals.
Oh, like in the old days of ransomware, where they were locking up people's photos and stuff.
Well, but no, it does say the Conti ransomware variant was the most popular, and I don't think Conti's ransoming individuals. I don't know how to make sense of this. Because like you were saying, the Conti ransomware, they made $180 million last year. And like you said, this is US centric for sure. Although if you look at it, there were complaints from other countries. If you go all the way to the end of the report, there's like a list of the countries where the victims were. So there were some international complaints. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is just companies not reporting to the FBI. But either way, BEC of 2.4 billion seems way, way worse than ransomware.
Yeah. And, you know, we're wondering, this might be thinking, you know, are we misprioritizing our defensive efforts, focusing too much on ransomware and not enough on BEC?
Now, here we go. So here's a securityaffairs.co. I'll stick this in the show notes. They say that ransomware gangs made $602 million in 2021. So yeah, so that indicates they only made a fourth of what the business email compromise people made.
Yeah, so I think their priorities might be out of whack here. with focusing on defending from ransomware when business email compromise is really where all the money is at.
That's interesting.
You know, it could be, you know, part of what we talked about before where, you know, if these are private companies being hit by ransomware, it's much easier for them to shield the fact that they've been ransomwared from the public than it is for a publicly traded company who has to report these kind of things on their SEC filings and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's wacky.
But still, you know, wondering if the reason that they, you know, people try to focus in on the ransomware versus the business email compromise is that it seems like there's an implied ability for someone outside of a company to be able to influence whether that organization got ransomware or not. Whereas with the business email compromise, there really is no one but that company that has to be able to defend against it. You know, because it's a social engineering human processes problem for the most part. And a third party is really not going to help me out with that. I would say the one possible exception to that would be that, you know, if you're a company and you're going to transfer $1 million or whatever, that's done through a financial institution. So it might be possible for, you know, that organization that's doing that, those transactions on your behalf to have some kind of fraud detection in algorithm or whatever monitoring that. But it would be really hard for them to tell because they aren't your business about whether that transaction is potentially fraudulent or not. So that's why I say it's unlikely that a third party can help, but not entirely impossible. So I think the bottom line for this article is make sure you review your business email compromise strategy. And this really focuses around how you handle money transfers for the most part. You know, how does your organization pay its vendors? How does it transfer money to other organizations? You know, ensure that process is as locked down as you can make it and preventing fraud. And with the deep fakes and everything, I would recommend some kind of cap or some indicator to say if there's any dollar amount above X, then you must have these assurances that who's asking for the transfer is who it's supposed to be. You know, maybe a FaceTime on an iPhone or, you know, a WebEx or a Zoom call or something where it's going to be much more difficult for them to deep fake their way around that versus simply an audio call or an email or something along those lines.
I mean, they can do deep fake audio now too.
Right. They did that with that the German company.
Yeah.
That's why I was saying that you should bring video into it or an in-person at some level of transaction. And depending on the organization, that number may vary. Obviously, if you're a small company, maybe that number is lower. If you're a large company, maybe it's higher. But at some point, you should have a mechanism in there to ensure that that transaction's being asked for by who's supposed to be, you know, a legitimate party.
All right. Anything else here?
Not other than don't ever give away your recovery, your crypto keys or your recovery phrase to anybody.
Yep. Not your keys, not your crypto. Speaking of crypto, the next article is crypto. This article is really interesting to me because, of course, I've been on a big crypto kick lately. $625 million stolen from Axie Infinity's Ronin Bridge, the largest ever crypto hack. The original article is from securityaffairs.co. I've got a bunch in the show notes, though. And the summary, I'm just going to go ahead and read the first sentence of the article because it's perfect. Actually, you know what? I'm not going to read it. It's exactly the same as the title. So pretty much describes it. The difference is it was Ethereum and USDC tokens, and it was discovered after a user tried to withdraw 5,000 ETH tokens and failed. And it was not discovered by the company, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Anyways, I did a little bit of research on what exactly is this play-to-earn game Axie Infinity, because I've been hearing about those quite a lot in the crypto space, and I've been kind of curious how they work. It is apparently a quite popular game overseas. You collect Pokemon-inspired creatures called Axies, which are NFTs. These NFT, these creatures, can be collected, they can be bred, and they can be sold. The land is also, it's like a 301 by 301 segment land. It's divided into plots that are also NFTs and can be bought, sold, although there's no function for them in the game just yet. There are two tokens involved. There are SLP tokens, which means small love potion, engaged in winning battles,
Wait, you get a love potion from winning a battle? Love
potion from winning a battle. Well, you can sell them. You can use them to breed the axes, or they can be traded for other tokens.
Oh, yeah. I see.
So that's why they're love potions. The axes have to be drunk in order to procreate. They're really just beers.
Oh, Guinness, the love potion.
Love potion. And then there's the AXS token, which is an ERC-20 utility token. I had to look up what ERC-20 means. That just means that it's a token that's on the Ethereum blockchain. These are given to the best players in the season as a reward, and they can be sold, staked, or traded. Interestingly enough here, if you stake it and you lock it up, that leads to further rewards, or it leads to in-game features, which is kind of a cool idea that you can get additional in-game features by staking coins, where you're not really spending the coin, but you're lending it to them for a while so they can do something with it. I don't know, loan it out or something. But then the token also has governance rights, allowing holders to vote and send governance proposals. Apparently that's not active yet, although it will be at one point.
So staking is kind of like a CD.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit the other day about proof of work versus proof of stake. Proof of stake is where you lock up your tokens, and then you're rewarded with more tokens. And they're looking to replace proof of work with proof of stake next year for Ethereum. And there's a bunch of currencies that already do it. And in this case, like I said, when you stake it, you lock it up for a while, and it leads to rewards, or at least in-game features, which is such an interesting idea for me. That's like renting an in-game feature. Can you imagine playing, I don't know, some sort of strategy game, and like, you know, oh, I'm going to stake, you know, 0.1 Ethereum, and that gives you, you know, season pass or something, but you got to stake it for 6 months or something. So I guess let them borrow it effectively for 6 months, and then they earn interest on it, or they loan it out or something. It'd be really interesting. It'd be a really interesting way of like paying for games, where you don't pay for it exactly. You loan somebody else the money, and then they make money off it for a while.
Oh man, imagine that. You're playing the game, right? And you need something in order to help you win. So you say, all right, I'm going to stake this amount of money to get this feature that's going to help me win. And then you get your ass beat anyway, and you're also out your stake.
Well, you're not out it forever. You're just out it, you know, for a while. Well, you know, so have you played any of those stupid pay to win like phone games?
Oh, no.
I think we talked a little bit about.
Yeah, I like playing games, but I'm terrible at them, so I would never risk any money.
I installed this game called like Age of Z on my phone. I played it for like a month, and you can totally play it for free, but it's as a phone game, as like an idle game, you know, upgrades are time gated. You know, your level one upgrade takes 30 seconds. Your level two upgrade takes a minute. Your level three, your level 20 upgrade takes a day and a half, but you can pay, you know, $3 to knock it down. I played SimCity on the phone, and that was the exact same way. You get to a certain point, you're just like, ugh, this is disgusting, because you have to pay in order to proceed. So this is just like another on that one. But here, to play, you need to buy an Axie. An article I was reading about this, which is in the show notes, they had a couple screenshots of the auctions for Axies. And the cheapest in the screenshot was $62.
And I assume that's based on like the capabilities of the Axie, right? You know, if it's a badass, it probably costs a lot more money than $60 or whatever.
The most expensive one was $170,000, which is ridiculous.
What? That can't even wrap my mind. You just broke my brain.
Yeah. They're,
Because what's your expected return on investment for buying an NFT worth that amount of money that you're going to use in some kind of fight?
So apparently the different axes, like you're talking about, they've got skills and they've got stats. So I imagine the higher priced ones have better stats. Apparently the CryptoKitty, the one that was sold for $170,000, was one of 100. I mean, 100's not that rare. I was wondering how much you can actually make playing Axie Infinity. Because again, like if a better Axie helps you make more money, then how much do you get back from it? So I found a Reddit thread from about 4 months ago where somebody asked this exact question. They said, how much can you make playing Axie Infinity? And a bunch of people responded. So I grabbed a couple of those responses. One person who had three Axies makes an average of 199 SLP tokens per day. Because apparently every time you participate in an arena and you win an arena, you get like 40 SLP tokens and you have energy, and the energy regenerates over time. So you can only take as many actions as you have energy, which I'm betting is what the more expensive axes have. They probably have more energy, so you can do more with them. or maybe they win more. I don't know. Anyways, that apparently was about $13 per day at the time the comment was made. Another respondent said that they made 70,000 SLP per month, or about $455. If I multiply out the $13 per day times 30 days, that actually comes out to about 420. So that's about, sounds about the same. So about $400 to $450 a month. So better and more axes apparently means more energy and therefore more SLP. And they've got this thing going called scholarships or guilds. And these are groups that purchase and then rent out the NFT assets, the axes required to play, in exchange for a cut of income. So one person posted that as a scholarship manager, he makes about $200,000 a year with 100 scholars. That's what they call the people underneath of them. Another person mentioned that he had been playing alone and then he had moved up to being a scholarship manager and he had five teams under him and he made $600 a month with no work on his own. He just, you know, owned the NFTs. So that's super interesting to me, actually, because critics have called this indentured labor. Which, yeah, that's, I don't think this exactly is exactly the same as, you know, people working out in the field or, but this is their income. This is how these people are making a living, which is very interesting.
What's that indenture? No.
Yeah. No. There's no contract involved. Right. Well, there is a contract, but if they stop playing, then the owner just gets the NFT back. Like there's no.
Yeah. They aren't trapped.
Yeah. Well, they may feel like it. So anyways, this is super interesting to me. This almost in some ways seems like the thing this most makes me think of is rental, like owning rental houses. Although my parents own some rental houses and apparently it's really hard work and you don't make that much off it. But this is, I don't know. I'm like, huh, how do I put $1,000 into Axie NFTs?
Well, and not lose all your money.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. You could probably build it into the smart contract. Like if you like, do you have to write your own smart contract to do this? I'm just so curious how the scholarship thing works. Like, do you have to trust them, or is there some way to monitor how much money they make? Is there like a smart contract or a DAO written such that it transfers ownership of the axes to them, but then it transfers 40%? I think the common cut here is like 40%, which is crazy.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it's a big cut.
No, but I would think, you know, if you were going to do something like that. I would say anything with kind of the crypto thing is like, you want to have some kind of process or method or way to get your money out of any online thing on a regular scheduled basis, based on criteria, you know, whether it's time or that you want to get that offline, because, you know, this all goes all the way back to Mt. Gox losing all that Bitcoin back in the day. Is that, you know, if you have it online and someone else is managing your keys, you know, that is not secure. Mm-hmm. Your stuff could be gone in a heartbeat, just like these guys' stuff was gone. So you want to be able to move that into an offline wallet on a regular basis, you know, whether you do it monthly or you do it for every $1,000 you get or some kind of process like that. Don't keep this stuff online for something, you know, where someone else is managing your keys. It's just not a wise thing to keep.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking about this. So if one team member with three axes makes an average of $13 a day, of course that was $13 a day 4 months ago, who knows what it is, who knows even what they cost now, but three axes costs a minimum of $62. The repayment on that, if you bought three axes, that's $186, divide that by $13 a day. And that is a 14-day repayment period. Now, if you were being a manager or a scholarship manager and you had three axes out and it was $182 and you loaned them out and you got 40% back, 40% of $13 is 186 divided by $5.20. That is a repayment period of 36 days. So just over a month. And then everything after that is profit. That is really interesting. I still think 40% is usury. You know, I could be a good scholarship manager and only take 20%.
Well, I wonder if it's something like hedge fund managers. I forget the number, but it's like, they call it like 555 or something like that, where virtually all hedge fund managers take the almost exact same percentage, or regardless of who the hedge fund manager is, a good hedge fund manager, bad hedge fund manager,
yeah.
They all get approximately the same percentage across the board. You know, so I'm wondering if it's the same kind of scenario here where that's the standard 40%, or if that's something that can be negotiated, because maybe you could build your portfolio, your stable or whatever you want to call it here, if you only charge 35% or 30%.
Yeah. I don't know if that would get me like more potential. If I charge less, would I get more and better people, or would I, or is there a reason they charge 40%? Like there's, for example, I know, again, I was looking into the rental houses thing and I was like, why are they charging so much for rent? But then when you actually go through and look at it and all of the stuff they have to do when the rent changes over, you know, if they're using a manager, they have to pay 10% out to the manager. They may have to repaint and redo carpets every time someone moves out. They have to save up for all the repairs and fees. They have to pay extra taxes. Like there's just all kinds of bits that add up that make it so you have to charge quite a bit more than your mortgage to make money on a rental. I wonder if there's costs that I'm unaware of, and that's why they charge so much. Or they might be just greedy. Who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to... I mean, the only thing I could think of is there would have to be fees built in, obviously, for... Because you're talking about a digital, so there's no real upkeep or anything like that. So there are fees in maintaining your scholarship, I suppose. That's where the money could go, but I have no idea.
Maybe. Anyways, that's all just pure speculation at this point.
I wonder if the cost has gone way down since this has happened.
There maybe was a drop, but it's gone back up.
A low swing.
No, unfortunately not.
But yeah, because they promised to pay back all this lost money. It was like, man, they have an extra $625 million laying around.
Well, they promised to pay it back. They have not yet paid it back. They actually posted some data about it. This is actually a pretty decent community alert for their revealing it. So they reported that Binance has resumed withdrawals for AXS and SLP tokens. They still are not having withdrawals of wrapped Ethereum, and the Ronin bridge is still not open. So you still can't buy in or get out. And that's kind of the other part of this too, is there are a lot of people that are like, this is how they're making their living in countries where $13 a day is a living, and they can't take money out, which... That really sucks. That's the equivalent of shutting down the banks here in the US. I don't know, that's definitely a potential issue with a private company like this, but I don't have much other to say other than that sucks. Anyway, so I'm currently taking a crypto class online, and one of the things that the author of the class has said in the first class is that crypto has a couple of kind of default things that are always going to happen. And one of them is it leads to enormous hacks, which are going to keep getting bigger and bigger, mostly because of the way just the smart contracts are set up and the sheer amounts of money that are in there. And yep, this is the biggest one we've seen yet. And he thinks they're just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So as to how the attack occurred, this occurred on the Ronin Bridge. The Ronin Bridge is a bridge in cryptocurrency parlance is how you bring money into and out of the ecosystem. So this was how they were doing it. This was how you could buy into it. And this was how you get your money back out to hopefully pay your bills. And the chain had 9 validator nodes, of which 5 were needed to validate a transaction. Somehow the attacker got control of 5 nodes. They did announce that the root cause of the attack was this small validator set, since they only had 9 nodes and you only needed 5 to validate a transaction. It made it trivially easy for the attacker to get access to them. They did say that this is the root cause was social engineering as well. All evidence points to social engineering rather than a technical flaw in the bridge. But there was, of course, a technical issue where they had an allow list. Apparently, at some point in the past, there was issues. There were too many transactions occurring, and they needed to let Sky Mavis, which is a company that owns Axie Infinity, sign transactions on behalf of the Axie DAO validator. So they set up an allow list that allowed Sky Mavis to use the RPC node, which is remote procedure call. It's basically an API endpoint. I don't know why they didn't just call it an API endpoint, but they didn't. And they set up an allow list that allowed them to reach this API endpoint and use it to sign transactions. Well, the attacker got access to that API endpoint. I don't know, they didn't say if that's because the allow list was too broad, or maybe the attacker was in the Sky Mavis infrastructure, so they were able to reach it. But they said specifically that the attacker was able to, quote, get the signature from the Axie DAO validator by using the gas-free RPC, which is, again, that's the API endpoint. So they didn't say how they got access to the 4 Sky Mavis validators. But I was actually listening to another podcast earlier. Unchained is a crypto podcast, and they happened to be discussing this. And he said that the guy on there said that he thinks that once they had access to the Axie DAO validator through that API endpoint, they were able to get the other four to sign the transactions to offload the crypto that way. Which, if that's true, that seems incredibly weak to me, that if you have access to one, you can get the other ones to also sign your transaction. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, so I guess since they're one of the steps they may be taking then after they get this thing sorted is they greatly increase the number of validator nodes that are required to validate a transaction, would reduce that likelihood of this occurring again.
Yeah. Well, again, I guess that means that there wasn't the access to just that one node that allowed them to access the other ones. Because if that was true, then adding more nodes doesn't mitigate that. Yeah, there's so much unknown here on how exactly it happened. I hate this kind of, where they just don't tell you enough information.
Well, they did reference, they said the attacker used hacked private keys in order to forge fake withdrawals.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe they actually got multiple keys, you know, five sets of keys.
Yeah. And then maybe they only had to have access to one via the API endpoint, but with the five private keys, they could tell it to approve. Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. Because one of the problems I had with the article, or I guess this is just kind of the way that people talk, that's not very, it's not precise as I would, but a statement published by the company said the attackers used hacked private keys in order to forge fake withdrawals. And it's kind of imprecise language with, you know, hacked private keys versus, you know, they weren't hacked, they were stolen. So I think it doesn't properly relay exactly what took place. And the withdrawals were not fake, they were real, they happened. And then they said that they forged the fake withdrawals. And I think that's not exactly precise either. It's probably more like the withdrawals were fraudulent, but forged, I don't think really reflects the exactly what happened there either. Mm-hmm. And this speaks to, you know, the lack of detail, you know, and the detail you get is stated in imprecise language. It doesn't tell you exactly what happened either.
Yeah. This is so frustrating sometimes where the words they use don't mean the things that they think they mean. So, all right. So I have a question here. How did the company not notice that they lost $625 million worth of coins? And how did they not notice until somebody tried to withdraw? So the fact that somebody tried to withdraw 5,000 ETH and noticed indicates to me that they tried to withdraw 5,000 ETH and failed. So that had to have been, how many ETH did they lose?
And like 17,000
or 170,000? I think it was 175,000. It's just, and I get it. There's a lot of transactions going on, but nobody was watching like their reserves. Nobody was watching how many, I don't know. That just blows my mind.
Well, I guess one thing we don't know, and we may never find out, is if they lost 625 million, what was in there?
Yeah. Out of 625 out of what?
Yeah, exactly. You don't know what the base is, so it could be
95% of their ETH.
I mean, or it could be 5%. You know, maybe they've got billions of dollars in there. I don't know.
No, but they couldn't have had that in there, because then that guy with the withdrawing the 5,000 ETH wouldn't have lost it. He would have been able to withdraw. So, I mean, they may have had more in like cold wallets and stuff, but they didn't have that much hot on the Ronin Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Cause I'm thinking it's just they have a reasonably high transaction volume, and they didn't, that amount didn't seem unusual to be transacted. But I would imagine that this probably all went to a very few number of other wallets. So if they were doing proper monitoring, they would have flagged that as unusual transactions because of the volume to a few number of destinations.
Yeah. I'm certain that, like, because we talked about this when we talked about hiding cryptocurrency, about one of the ways to hide it is to send it to a whole bunch of different wallets. Either way, I'm sure that this would have been a huge spike on their numbers for how much outflow there was. I can't imagine there's $625 million of outflow a day.
Yeah. I mean, either way it comes down to, they were not doing proper monitoring.
Yeah.
Because I think this would be very hard to hide, regardless of how it took place.
I agree. It was pointed out as well on that the Unchained podcast I was listening to earlier, where this is a lot of money to try and wash and launder. And this apparently, and the guy that they were interviewing said that $625 million is too much for Tornado Cash. Like, it's just too big. You can't put this in. And then there's just not enough other Ethereum and USDC in there to allow you'd have to wash it as multiple smaller transactions.
It's just like stealing the Mona Lisa. You know, you got it. It's worth a whole bunch of money.
What are you going to do?
How are you going to get your hands on that money? Yeah. Whereas if they were less, you know, suffered from less avarice and said, well, we're going to get 20 million or 25 million, you know, they could easily, more easily have gotten it, washed it. And who knows if when they would have discovered the problem.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Especially if they didn't discover years. $625 million for 6 weeks. Yeah. It may have been decades. They may have been like the last people to try and cash out of the company or like, hey, wait a second. Why can't we get our money out?
They can be retired old men before anybody found out.
Yeah. So
they
wouldn't
even have to do a Hans Gruber.
That's right. Yeah. I was going to go to that. So, okay. So this attack happened on, they announced it on 3/29. And I'm looking at the, on 3/29, the AXS.
On the 23rd, I think.
No, right? But they announced it on the 29th. Remember, it took them six days to figure it out.
Yeah.
The token went from $69 to $65. And then over the next couple of days, the token, the AXS token dropped to 60, but it's back up to, it hit 75 and it's up, it's at 66 now. So this doesn't seem to have hurt the AXS token at all.
Hmm.
That's crazy. Let's see if they've got this. They've got smooth love potions, or 2 cents each. Is that the? Is that what it was called? I thought it was a different word. Maybe there's two small love potion.
And Zima instead of Hennessy. I don't know.
Yeah, this one dropped from 2.2 cents down to 2.0 cents, or 1.95 cents. So like a 10% drop. But it's back up and bouncing around. So this doesn't look like this hurt their tokens at all. It's really interesting.
Hmm.
Excuse me.
I don't know. Crypto is weird.
Crypto is weird. Yeah. Yep. So Axie pledged to reimburse players who lost funds. They could probably reimburse the players, I imagine. I mean, all these people are putting this money into Axie for the, I mean, every person that buys a new NFT for $60, it doesn't cost Axie Infinity to create that. So I'm
sure.
Yeah, I
was
going to
say, how do they produce this? I mean, if it's just by, you know, can they print it? I mean, can they print the 625?
Yeah. I mean, what are they? Maybe they'll release a special Axie thing. You know, only 100 of them. They're really awesome, but you got to pay $2,000 each or something like that. And start. I mean, they're basically printing money. All right. Well, in terms of why does this matter, this is a lot of flipping money, and especially because this is something that people are doing to make their livelihood. I think that Sky Mavis needs to do a better job. People rely on them. And if you're doing crypto as a company, you need to be doing a better job than normal companies. If a normal company has a business email compromise and they wire money to the third party, they have 24 hours to get it back. If you're in a crypto company and you send the money, it's gone.
Yeah, and it's not your money.
Yeah, this is the player's money that they're giving you and they're making money off of. That being said, actually, I was thinking about that. Technically, with a blockchain, couldn't you write a blockchain that would do like a 24-hour escrow or something? I mean, it loses some of the ability of some of the good things about the blockchain where you can't reverse payments.
I mean, all transactions would be delayed then.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of some way where, I don't know, something that would make this a little bit safer for people without losing the disadvantages of just doing like credit cards. And because like a credit card transaction, the credit card company will let you reverse that like months later. Wire transfers you can't, although you might be able to 24 hours if you're a big company.
Well, it depends on the law, because one of the reasons that the credit card companies can do that is because they're responsible for all but $50 worth of fraud on any transaction.
Yeah.
So either way that they're it's going to cost then. So it's better from a customer service perspective or a customer satisfaction perspective for them to do that.
I think if I was writing something like this, I would probably put, if I was writing the smart contract for these new tokens, something like this, I'd probably set it so that small transactions had an instant transfer, but big transactions had a waiting period that was corresponding to the size of the transaction. Because like when you're talking these SLP love potions, I don't think anybody's transferring $10 million of SLP or whatever, or I guess on their bridge. No, because you're right. They weren't transferring these tokens. They were transferring Ethereum and USDC. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Sure, somebody smarter than me can figure it out.
I'll solve it next week.
Okay, well, however you solve it, make sure you can make some money doing it.
Maybe I'll have some indentured servants playing games for me.
I already have some of those. They're called bots.
They're called bots. Dang.
That's what I was thinking. You know, if you could write a bot to do some of this stuff, you might be able to make a decent amount of money in this, doing these shenanigans with the Axie and whatnot.
Yeah, if it was like simple enough that it just had to log in. I guess it depends on how much you make if you win versus if you, because the game looked pretty simple. Like you just jump in an arena and you use your skills, and it didn't look like it was, you know, Rainbow Six Siege or anything.
So, yeah, well, I mean, imagine that you could write a relatively simple bot that has a 50% chance of winning against a novice player.
Yeah.
You know, depending on how many of those axes you have, so you might just be able to sit back and just rake in the money.
Yeah. Yeah, because at no effort on your part, you just buy them. And like I said, if you could get $13 a day for your $62, your payback's real quick, especially if you snowballed it and like you turned your winnings into new axes and...
Right.
It'd be interesting, especially if you got winning, especially if you got tokens, even if you lost. Like maybe you can make $13 a day playing with a human who wins most of their attacks. But if your bot loses every time, but you still get like $1.30, like that might still be worth it.
It depends on how long it takes them to lose.
No, it doesn't really. Because it's a bot doing it. Like it's no skin off your back if it takes them 2 hours to lose or 10 hours to lose.
Yeah, it does. Because I mean, if it takes them 10 hours to lose, then that bot's only good for $2 a day.
Well, remember though, they're it's not time limited. It's energy limited. So you couldn't play all day if you wanted to with one Axie. Each Axie only has 40 energy, and I don't know how much energy is taken by attacking or whatever, but.
And that's recouped via time outside the arena?
Yeah, it goes over time.
Okay.
So although I'm sure they let you.
Buy energy?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, you can probably trade those SLP tokens for energy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if you could bot this, though, someone would have done it already.
Yeah. Well, again, this may be a case where it's cheaper to do it with humans. Kind of like how, what is that? The Turk, the Mechanical Turk service works. For some things, it's difficult to automate. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.